Episode 22 of the KMO Show, Wednesday, July 3rd, 2024.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another installment of the KMO Show. I realize it has been a very long time since I put one of these out, and that's because I spend most of my creative time and effort writing these days. I'm writing fiction, and I also post to Substack twice a week on Tuesdays and Thursdays. So what I have for you here is most of a conversation that I recorded recently. Actually, it's been over a week now, because I'm just out of the podcasting habit, but this is a conversation with Douglas Rushkoff, who I imagine needs little introduction. Douglas Rushkoff first came to my attention when I picked up one of his books, Media Virus, off the bookshelf at the university bookstore at the University of Missouri in Columbia, Missouri, in, I'm not sure what year, the early 90s. And this was the early days of the internet. This was before the World Wide Web. But email existed, and Usenet existed, and The Well existed, and bulletin boards existed, and somehow I got in touch with Douglas Rushkoff. He may have put his email address in the book, for all I remember. But I have been corresponding with him since the mid-90s. And he has appeared many times on the Sea Realm podcast. He's a very busy man these days, and it took quite a while after I asked him to come on the show. Actually, I invited him to be on the Padverb podcast. And while he couldn't do it right away, he would check in with me every few months to say, yeah, you're still on the list. But he does several podcast interviews a day. So I was happy that my turn finally came around, although the Padverb podcast is no longer in production. So you're getting it here on the KMO Show. So my interest these days is largely in artificial intelligence. As I've mentioned before, I think, on this podcast, my academic experience, particularly in grad school, focused on the philosophy of science and the philosophy of mind. And in the philosophy of mind, I was mostly interested in artificial intelligence. And back then, in the mid-90s, I guess this is the getting on toward the late 90s by this point, my interest was sparked. I wasn't actively involved in this research. I was just reading about it, but it was sparked by this idea that one could emulate a neural network in a computer model, and rather than writing code, train the model and condition its outputs. And this was just speculative at the time, but that is the basis for large language models and diffusion models and all other applications of neural nets these days. So from my perspective, this is a terribly interesting time to be alive. But one of Doug's most recent books and the name of his podcast is Team Human. And he is definitely on the side of humanity. And I am as well. I don't necessarily think that artificial intelligence and humanity must necessarily be in conflict. Although if we get things wrong, particularly in the study and the practice of what's known as alignment in artificial intelligence, well, as Eliezer Yudkowsky likes to say, we have to get it right the first time. There won't be a second chance. So as you listen, you may notice that Doug and I are coming at the topic of artificial intelligence from different perspectives. So here's my most recent conversation with Douglas Rushkoff.
All right.
So, hey. Man who needs no introduction. Douglas Rushkoff, do you remember when we started corresponding?
I don't remember when we started corresponding. I remember when I met you, it was you like drove me from my hotel to my airport in like Seattle or somewhere.
Memory is a funny thing.
You had a cassette in a car. You used to do your interviews in the car, I remember.
I did used to record interviews in my pickup truck. I picked you up from an airport in Washington, D.C. in that pickup truck and drove you to Crystal City, Virginia, where we sat on a landing in a stairwell and recorded a conversation on a portable recorder. And then you gave a talk there at NPR. No, not NPR, PBS. But that was not the first time we met. The first time we met was in a hotel restaurant, forget which hotel, but it was kind of near Central Park. And I was there in 1999 with Richard Brody. We were hanging out, and then we were going to skip down to Washington, D.C. for a conference at the Cato Institute about ending the drug war.
Huh.
But that was when we met the first time. We started corresponding in the mid-90s about your book, Media Virus.
Hmm.
And you are one of the first handful of people that I first met online and then met in person.
Oh, and now it's everybody.
Now I'm a hermit. I just don't meet people at all.
But remember, the interesting thing was back then, because the internet was asynchronous and you would take so much time in preparing whatever you wrote to upload to a bulletin board, or, you know, you'd spend an evening crafting a single 2-paragraph email, that meeting someone in real life after you knew them online was a little scary because they had seen such a smarter, more articulate, considered self on the internet, you know, and that you thought, oh shit, you know, now when they see me live, they're going to realize I'm just, I can't speak like I write or anything. And now it's so the opposite, you know, where, you know, people's online persona is so, you know, brusque and trollish compared to, you know, let me just get this asshole person in my comments. Like, let me just get him for 5 minutes in real life, you know, and I could probably recalibrate this whole conversation.
Well, I'm glad. I like how you ended that. when you said, if I could just get him for 5 minutes, recalibrating the conversation, you know, via fisticuffs is what I was thinking.
No, to worst case, pacing and leading, you know, a little, you know, back to Richard Brody there, a little neurolinguistic programming and, you know, modeling of the other in order to help, you know, bring them to a better place.
But when we first met, even in person, when we first met, December.
You were disgusted. You were just disgusted.
Oh, no. We were both much younger then.
Yeah.
And we both looked excellent.
Okay.
But December 21st, 2012 was like a decade and a half in the future. And I was basically a singularitarian at the time. Like I, for years, I described myself as a recovering libertarian and recovering singularitarian simply because I had gotten over those ideologies. I had recognized them as the ideologies they were and sort of held them at arm's length, but hadn't really replaced them with anything. And I still haven't. Actually, I definitely put the singularitarianism on the shelf because I was a peak oil doomer for about a decade. And unfortunately, that's where I picked up most of my audience. And eventually I just came to see the peak oil doomerism as a psychological phenomenon and not anything that's any, you know, it's any sort of output of a dispassionate examination of the, you know, biophysical evidence of the world around us. You know, I just came to see it as a mania and a psychological defense mechanism and an excuse, you know, for not fully engaging with the world as it is. But anyway, most of my audience, when I made that turn, they said, well, we're going to stick with the doom. So we're going to go find a different voice of doom. And the people that stuck with me, there's some pretty cool people, I have to say.
Yeah.
And that's been a few years now. And so I studied philosophy of mind when I was in grad school in the 90s, you know, when I was first corresponding with you about Media Virus. And at the time, you know, there were these basically theoretical entities about, or, you know, theoretical notions about how you might generate artificial intelligence using this crazy thing called artificial neural networks. People had built a few very simple ones, but they weren't good for anything. And now we are living in a world that is transformed or is in the early stages of being transformed by, you know, machine learning, mostly using artificial neural networks and training runs, you know, with gobbling huge amounts of electricity and compute. I hate that word compute, but I've come around to it. And basically the stuff that I was fascinated by in the 90s, and which I thought was just around the corner in the 90s, didn't show up for another couple of decades. And in that couple of decades, you know, I lived my life. And it didn't go like I had planned. But now the AI seems to be here. And at the same time, you know, that whole same period, I was vehemently against the drug war. And now the drug war seems to be winding down, like, in the worst way possible. Like, you can still go to jail for doing acid, or you can still go to jail for growing pot. But, you know, if you want to shoot heroin on the streets, and, you know, not heroin anymore, but some synthetic monstrosity, nobody's going to do anything to stop you. Go for it. Not everywhere, but in certain cities. Anyway, and now that AI's come along, you know, I think people who are really fascinated by the topic back in the 90s and who are really into it, you know, the Ray Kurzweils of the world, kind of skipped over the whole, hey, how do we transition from people working jobs in order to earn money to provision themselves to a world where the machines are doing that? And the machines are starting to do the work now, but we haven't figured out the, you know, the alternative provisioning. So anyway, I'm just jabbering. I mean, these are the things that I have on my mind, and I've been looking through your Substack, and I realize that you are thinking about the exact same issues. So why don't you talk now?
Huh. Yeah, there's a big swirl going on inside you right now. and I hear in it some of the same urge, even though you are recovering, you're a recovering collapsnik. Mm-hmm. That there's, I hear, and I sometimes have it too, the same urge to be able to create a map or a portrait or a schema that somehow holds these various phenomena. And I don't know that we can do that quite logically or even metaphorically, as Terence McKenna might have. You know, it was a simpler time when you could go, well, this is like the birth of a baby and the mother's sweating and it looks like she's dying, but she's actually creating the next phase of humanity. And, you know, or an evolutionary model or this. It's like you've got, you know, the Marxists are flummoxed because there's so many different conditions on the ground to analyze that there's really sort of no logical mathematical proof to explain it all on an evidentiary way. And the fascists or capitalists are flummoxed because there's no guiding metaphor for what we're going through either. So I think it ends up being up to the anarchists and the Buddhists to describe all of this more experientially than in either of those two ways. You know, I've always been more a conditions on the ground person because who is being harmed right now by this is real. You know, so when you're analyzing whatever AI, all I could look at, what is the primary impact of AI on our reality, is environmental pollution and slavery, right? That's the main two things that it's doing. And maybe it's helping kids write term papers or something, I don't know, or sequencing something, or you know, there's some functions it may have kind of someday. But, you know, the conditions on the ground, it's good as a kind of leftist Marxist caring about people and babies in Africa. It's an easier approach than the sort of more Ray Kurzweil-y, and I've gone there too with books like Team Human, which are, you know, highly metaphorical, which is why sort of the Steve Bannon crowd likes that work of mine, because they think in metaphors and humans and the ground and getting away from the yoke of, you know, the technocracy and liberating, and that's that side. But I guess now, and as I hear you as a kind of a reflection of my own inner state, and I understand the sort of the audience capture that a collapse mentality creates, and people love that shit. They love it. I mean, every day in my inbox are at least two emails from podcasters or journalists wanting to talk about the time that I was sitting with five billionaires at a table and they wanted advice on their bunkers. You know, that is sadly, perhaps, the image that I'm asked about the most. I mean, and it's fine. It's a great trailhead to a bigger conversation about capitalism, technology, colonialism, and you know, the paucity of any humanity among the people who are developing the platforms on which where our society is operating. But it's also an indication of the same sort of audience or wide public urge to have people preach doomsday to them, you know, which is something that I'm trying to avoid, you know, because on some level, I feel like some kind of doomsday is inevitable at this point. And the things that we would do to prevent it are different. Now, I feel like we are at this place, this dangerous, brittle place where for most of us, our last best hope of avoiding or mitigating the impact of the coming crises is an internal, more social, spiritual shift than you know, putting plastics in a different bin.
Can I interrupt you for a sec?
Sure, I'm done.
Okay. I remember a few years back, and, you know, given how old we are, it might have been more than a few. But at one point, I recall you posting or writing something somewhere saying, you know what, I'm done. I'm over the idea that I'm going to make the world better by reframing it for myself. I really want it to be better now. Mm. Do you remember saying something to that effect?
Yeah, I mean, it might have been, you know, around 2013, 2014 when I was...
just the other day.
I was going to start teaching. You know, that's when I decided to go, you know, get a job at a public university and teach, you know, undergraduates and you know, and some master students, but people who were like, you know, the first generation in their family to go to college. And yeah, it seemed... and it was around after Occupy and all. It was like, all right, enough of this, enough talking, enough talking and framing and this and that. Because, you know, you reframe something and then someone else reframes it right back at you. You know, it just becomes like an online bulletin board conversation. You know, my framing only works as long until some capitalist or asshole reframes it as you know, whatever they want to see it as.
But now,
well, now it's a similar shift toward reality, you know. Except I'm realizing that the dashboard to reality creation may be more embodied and social than it is. Than it is policy or politics for that matter. You know, that there are these systems that are in place that are trying to do these things, but they are really brittle. They're really, I hate to call them broken, but they're dysfunctional right now. And I don't know that getting further mentally involved in those arguments is the best path toward widespread collective coherence. You know, I feel like if people could operate more coherently, they would, of course, make better political choices. And if billionaires weren't afraid of the apocalypse, or if they didn't accept it as an inevitability, then they might be spending more of their effort making the world a better place rather than collecting the money and technology they need to escape from it. Things like that. But the prerequisite to that is a different experience of the world, an experience of people, of other people as potential friends and collaborators rather than obstacles to one's own transcendence.
Let me show you something.
Fear and Loathing in the Kuiper Belt.
Kuiper Belt.
Kuiper Belt.
Yeah. It's a science fiction novel. I wrote it last year.
Mm.
And I wrote it when, like, I had heard that there were some interesting AI writing tools.
Mm.
And I went and I checked out a few, and they were terrible. But one of them promised to be able to match your writing style. So I had this story in mind and I wrote the first scene and fed it to this AI and said, okay, show me what you got. And what it had was terrible. But I went to a different platform and I wrote another scene and said, hey, what, you know, build on this. And I just didn't like what it offered me. But then I'd written two scenes and, you know, so I just wrote a third and the fourth and then, you know, I've got a 700 page manuscript that I have to like pare down, and I got it down to like 564 pages. But the AI, you know, as a writer was just, and this is, you know, a year ago, which is forever in AI development time, but it was terrible. But there's a model called Claude that you can dump big chunks of text into, like, you know, 30,000 words at a time. And so I would just, you know, write my own stuff and share it with Claude and talk about it with Claude. And that was very enjoyable until the novel got too long that I couldn't share it with Claude anymore. And then I found myself spending more time creating summaries and whatnot to feed to Claude than I was, you know, than I wanted to. And I just set it aside, you know, set the AI aspect of it aside and just finished writing the novel. But I think you have been comparing notes with a large language model in the production of some fiction that you're writing, a graphic novel, if I recall.
Yeah, I mean, I tried. I wanted to see what it would do. You know, there were a few problems with it. I mean, mainly, as you described the process, you kind of do all the work yourself, figuring out, you know, here's the characters and here's kind of the story I want and here's the style. So you do all of the work that the intern, you know, if you hired an intern, that they might do for you when you're writing a graphic novel. And then you give the AI the part that you would do, which is the fun part. So kind of why do that? Why be a graphic novel writer if you're having the AI do it? Well, you're not a graphic novel writer at that point. You're a graphic novel publisher, you know, using whatever, you know, hoping that the reversion to the mean, you know, that the examples that the AI is able to mine and reassemble is interesting enough to put on the market. But yeah, it wasn't fun. And the thing that kind of can be fun is engaging with the AI, you know, is playing with, here's my scene, what do you think? And let it comment or something. You know, a living experience with an AI is way more interesting than whatever artifact the AI might deliver. So you hear the story of, oh, I was working with Midjourney and I did this, and then it did that. And then I was with ChatGPT and I said this, and then it said that. And how did it know that I was thinking this? And it's great, but it's looking at the result, at the artifact that the interaction produced, is like listening to someone else's acid trip. Yep. You know, it's like, good, I'm glad you had that experience, but dude, the lobster claws crawling through your brain, that doesn't translate to me to anything. So I feel like it's that. So people are kind of missing the point of AI. It's not to produce industrial artifacts that replace art. It's to have an experience. So if I were, you know, and I was for a little bit, if I were involved in kind of a creative AI exercise, it would be to give people the opportunity to play with AI. But as we know from Pareto Principle, 20% of people are interested in doing the thing, and 80% of people are interested in just looking at the results of that thing. So where I've been wrong about the internet from the beginning is I thought, oh, people are going to want to be involved, engaged. They're going to want to write. You know, but people didn't want to write. They kind of wanted to read. They didn't want to program. They wanted to play. You know, the number of people that moved even up to the level of Doom engagement, where you create your own mods of the game, was very, very small. And it seemed to me that was the whole point, that you play Doom for a while, and then once you understand the game, you create Doom in the corridors of your high school, or, you know, the streets of your town, get people upset, you know, or learn to program your own game. But people they don't see that. You know, the printing press came and people read books. They didn't write books. The few still wrote the books. You know, computers come and the few program, and everybody else just, you know, swipes TikTok.
Yeah. Most people still want to consume regardless of the tools that you give them for creation.
Right. And that's partly because the tools are not, for the most part, not genuinely offered in a way that allows for creation. It's partly the cultural framework we have around creativity kind of as work and consumption as play, which is also odd. You know, people don't think of dancing as work, right? If you go to a rave or something and you dance and you create your own dance, it's sort of like creativity comes out of that. They don't think of creativity and sex as work, right? That's creativity. So, and it's as creative as things get, ultimately, if you you know, do it organically. So it's odd, but, you know, that's, and I think it's largely because these tools still come to us in our industrial age framework. You know, in the industrial age, technology was always about increasing efficiency and increasing the, you know, speed of outputs and decreasing the required competence of the worker. And that's what it was for. You have an assembly line, so you don't have to know how to make a shoe. You just have to know how to get one nail in there. And as long as we see technology as a de-skilling, and as long as we use AI the way we're talking about it now as a way of de-skilling writers, you know, so that, I guess, writers don't have to be paid. You know, Hollywood can just make Marvel movies without any human intervention. You know, you get those results, but you also get that frame around this stuff, which is why it's generally being used in the most uninteresting way possible.
Part of the objection that the Hollywood writers and actors had with their strike last year was, you know, they wanted some provisions in their contracts, their contractual agreements with the studios, that they wouldn't be replaced with AI, but at the same time, they wanted the option of using AI tools themselves.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it sounds maybe hypocritical on some level, but I don't think it is. You know, people, when you interact with AI, I know from personal experience, it can stimulate creativity. It doesn't mean you have outsourced the creativity to the tool, but the interaction with the tool produces an experience, and that experience finds its way into the product that you as the artist create. So I don't think it's crazy for the, you know, the writers to say, hey, we want to be able to use AI. We just don't want you, the studio heads, to, you know, replace us with it. I think that's legit, but it's not necessarily legit.
It's just, you know, right now where we still have kind of an industrial age union model toward it. So if you have Teamsters working on a loading bay, and now there's the invention of the hydraulic forklift. It's like, oh, well, now we don't need five guys to move that crate anymore. We could do it with two. You know, so if you look at AI that way, it's like, oh, how many fewer people do I need now in order to make the movie cheaper, I guess. But I'm going to start losing audience because there's not enough people being paid movie tickets to do it. It's like, it all depends. That's why I want to go back to culture. It's like, when I think about theater, it's like, okay, if I had low-cost robots, I could do Waiting for Godot, right? Or whatever. Or I could do, instead of the budget of Waiting for Godot, I could go do Les Mis, you know? And do I even want to? It's like, for me, directing plays was always really the excuse to engage with people for 6 or 8 weeks in a very special way. You know, I liked directing way more than acting because for me, it was the rehearsal process that was the fun part. And then once you're doing the show, after a couple of weeks, you're doing the same play again and again and again. You know, I mean, I know there's reasons to do it and there's form, and God bless people who can, you know, that Jeremy Strong can do Enemy of the People 8 times a week at that level is a marvelous thing. I could not do that because that's a different, he's doing something else. But for me, the collaborating with the people, the play is not the thing. It's the playing is the thing, you know, with the others. So if you understand work like that, you know, that you want as many humans as possible collaborating and playing and socializing, that so many of our human pursuits are excuses to do that. You know, even now it's like guys go, like here where I'm living now, guys go hunting, right? They put on these special clothes and they have long guns or shot. I don't know what they're using, but big things that strap on there, and they walk around in the woods, you know, and they got like coffee things and sandwiches, and they're not shooting because they need the food, right? They're still hunting because they like being together and killing something, I guess. I mean, whatever they like the social aspect of it. So it's back to this, a great theorist who wrote a book, Homo Ludens, which means man the player. Instead of Homo sapiens, man the knower, we should have been Homo Ludens, he said. And what he says in the early part of that book is, you know, most people think that dogs, you know, play when they're little and stuff and jump around on each other as ways of training each other for the hunt and practicing for hunting. And he said, no, dogs hunt in order to have the time and energy to play, that the play is the point, that that's the object of the game for them, is to get to play. And I look at life that way too, and just feel like, and partly because of scarcity and partly because of the way our society's been organized, you know, we have the reverse, understanding of this, you know, that we're stuck in our, in an unnecessary competition for resources, I guess. You know, this whole AI unemployment problem has always seemed like such a joke to me. It's like, oh, because we have an economic model that cannot contend with bounty. We don't know how to live in a world where robots would do all the work and we could do all the play. We don't even know how to live in a world where we don't need oil and other scarce extraction-based commodities for energy. You know, if we actually had, you know, fusion or some great, you know, non-resource depleting source of energy, we would not know how to do it as a society, because so much is based on that wealth creation.
Well, I talk to not a lot of people, but I hear from, you know, people about AI, and they're typically approaching it from, you know, based on mental models that they acquired from science fiction. Mm. You know, if you go back and you look at science fiction dealing with the emergence of artificial intelligence, no science fiction author predicted a future where AI could like make music and paint and write poetry, but couldn't do math. You know, that just didn't fit the notion. The computer was supposed to be logical, analytical, rigorously mathematical, and not have a soul and talk like this, you know, but computers or AI still not very good at math, but they can speak beautifully. You know, so
it can speak beautifully, but because it's not an organic form, it can't do what mushrooms do. It can't metabolize trauma. It can't exercise compassion. You know, it can mirror, it can talk, it can create various illusions and sensations. So yeah, you could fuck a robot, or a robot could bring an old person a tea, you know, and say, "Dear, how are you?" and make them feel good for a moment. But it can't actually do the thing. Like, it can't be a doula or a Buddha or a Buddha, like the way we are to each other. It can't, you know, sit at the bedside of a dying person and help them metabolize their transition. It can't hold space for someone having a psilocybin trip and help physically metabolize what that person is going through. It can't do the things that human beings and organic matter does for each other. It can model those activities, which is valuable. How does it model it so that I could see how to do it better in real life? But it's all map and no territory.
I could quibble with that, but instead I'll go back to the point that I was driving toward, which is that I encounter a lot of people who give me evidence that people are thinking about AI in terms of science fiction examples, which are not a very ready guide. Science fiction didn't predict actual artificial intelligence very well. And a lot of people, particularly in media, I mean, one of the first things they revert to is the Terminator and Skynet, in which there is an all-out, you know, war for existential conflict between artificial intelligence and humanity. And I think a much better science fiction model to think with is Dune and the Butlerian Jihad, which is something that happened, you know, thousands of years in the past in terms of the story of Dune. But in the very brief description that Frank Herbert gives of it, and I haven't read, you know, the numerous elaborations by his son, but in the original work, the Butlerian Jihad was a war fought not humans against machines, but one faction of humans who had been dominated by another faction using artificial intelligence. So it was not machines coercing humans, it was humans using machines to coerce humans. And the outcome of the war was to establish, as a religion, you know, as a universal religion, a prohibition on creating those kinds of tools. And to compensate for the lack of these tools, humanity had to upgrade itself so that you would have navigators who had special mental abilities that, you know, to allow for space travel. You had mentats who had special mental abilities that would replace, you know, computers, which were absent. And I think that's a much richer way to think about the, you know, the potential downsides of artificial intelligence, because so much of what we're worrying about, you know, the loss of jobs and people being socially isolated and things like that, these trends were already underway before large language models were good for anything, you know. So AI might accelerate these processes, and we might look to blame AI for things like technological unemployment, but that was ongoing. That's not something that AI did to us. That's something that, as you've mentioned, our economic system imposes on us, because it has a logic of its own, and you know, we don't really understand where the brake is or how to change gears or even, you know, get out of the vehicle entirely and walk.
Yeah. I mean, I except when I'm asked about it in like a podcast or something, I generally don't think about AI at all. I'm just not interested in it. You know, I even had a friend, a great artist, whatever, who's, you know, writing these novels with AI, and there's sort of him and AI, and I feel almost it's a strong word to use, but almost insulted as a human being that I'm supposed to take time and even read a page written by the friggin'. Why am I wasting my time looking at what your computer create? I don't care. I deeply don't care. However profound you think it might be, just fucking tell me then. You know, I don't care. So when I hear about the AI of science fiction writers, I don't think they were writing about AI, really. I think those science fiction writers were writing about capitalism, you know, as you say. So what happens when a mindset, when a way of thinking about the world is mistaken for the world? You know, you're going to get problems. And even when you look at you know, Kubrick and HAL and that's not about the AI. What it was about, who told the AI what? You know, the AI the AI assumed it was in charge because it was told secrets that the astronauts were not. And when it realized, that's the moment when it realizes the astronaut doesn't know what it knows, it goes, oh, okay. And then it decides, and that's, so it's about secrecy. And it was the company keeping a secret what was going on and the mining, what they were doing and where. So again, and that even in that case, it was business, you know, it was business. And, you know, when I think about my fear of AI, if I have one, is that if we or our companies tell AI to figure out ways to get human beings to believe something and to use every tool at their disposal to get us to believe something, you know, and I don't just mean like, you know, Russian disinfo, but let's go with big things like, you know, the money or you know, an economic system or a power system that we could kind of almost, you know, irreversibly kind of hypnotize us into a belief system even better than, you know, Mao or Hitler or Stalin or whoever did. And that would be really dangerous. You know, using whatever, Freudian, Pavlovian, behavioral finance, NLP, you give every tool to these things and they will use them and iterate them on their 8 billion person sample until they got us, which is why I go back to spirit and love and sex and human experience and socializing, that the only, I feel like the only defense we have is each other, is our rapport together. That if you are having like great sex with another person, it's going to be very hard for an AI to tell you, oh, this other experience is better than that. right? If you're laughing with 10 people around a fire telling stories, it's really hard for some Netflix on an iPad to tell you, oh no, watch this instead of that. You know, if you are engaged with people in your community, digging an irrigation ditch, it's really hard for a politician to convince you about, you know, some, you know, giant supply chain that's supposed to eventually get to you. You know, so I'm sort of, that's sort of why I'm at this stage in my career trying to return to the power of the body, embodied experience, local reality, that even though I want you to care about the world, you know, you're only going to have like 2% impact through what, your phone on the government. You know, yes, vote, go out every 4 years, every 2 years, whatever it is, and vote and campaign and be involved in civics. But the 98% of your time should be right in your body, in your community. And, you know, if we can take care of ourselves and each other, it makes those big systems that we're also obsessed with way less important.
You know, you wrote a Substack piece, I think it's your most recent one, talking about a concert party type event in memory of Genesis P. Orridge. Mm. And one thing I want to say is you mentioned David Jay, and I'm a huge Love and Rockets fan from back in the day, and a big,
I know, and thrill. Imagine being on stage playing with David Jay. So we're playing this song, Suspicious, right? And this was actually in the rehearsal room. Again, rehearsal, right? Mm-hmm. We're practicing the song. David Jay comes in, just so, he fucking cool. He's just so cool. He's a grown-up, right? He's even older than us, but he's wearing this like black velvet sport coat and this red hair. He's just like walks in and I'm just like, I just want to be you, you know, that moment. So we're playing this song Suspicious, and I'd been practicing it in my little office here, you know, for a week, knowing that he's going to be the one singing it. And I came up with a couple of little sort of, I was doing keyboards, a kind of a piano riff. And I practiced it a bunch here because it just sounded, it was really light, but it worked in this one little section. And we're rehearsing it for the first time in there. And he's singing the song and looking at the lyrics and all, and trying to get into it. And I did the little piano riff, and he turns his head right to me and his eyes open and he smiles and gives me this thumbs up just to say, I heard what you did. I got that. That's good. You know, cause I kind of gospeled this song that it was more Lou Reed to begin with. And I added a couple of gospel licks, and it was just like, David Jay just smiled. And it was like, Nothing better. Just kind of to both fangirl and collaborate at the same time was just like too much. Mm. Anyway, sorry.
Oh, that's a great anecdote. Yeah. I mean, I was going to share one where, you know, when I was in Seattle working at Amazon, I was one of the first 100 employees at Amazon.
Oh my God. Are you a billionaire?
No, I sold my stock, immediately upon leaving the company. And, I got like $666,000 out of it, where if I'd held on to it, it would have been many millions.
Would it? Yeah. Oh, well.
Who so knew? It goes. Yeah.
Yeah.
but one, yeah, we worked long, long ass hours.
Right.
You know, in those early days. And so I was, you know, I lived a half a block from the office where I worked. So, you know, I would just, there were times when in the winter, you know, the days are short, I would never see the sun. I would walk to work before, you know, the sun came up, and what the heck is that? Alexa, stop.
Oh, wow. She knows you're talking about Amazon.
Actually, no, it's every day at this time, it starts playing white noise.
Is there a reason?
Yeah, it's when I'm writing, and it's just to drown out other sounds. Wow. So I'm not distracted. So anyway, I'm stretching out. I'm making a Shaggy Dog story out of the fact that I was just, you know, wigged out from overwork and, you know, just focusing on screens too much. And one day I walked out of the office and I was just going to get some lunch. And I'm in that state of, oh, wow, the sky, I'm seeing the sky. And this figure comes walking up to me, and it's a crazily familiar figure. And I'm having trouble, like, you know, the context just isn't working. And then as we got closer, I realized, oh shit, it's Daniel Ash. Mm.
And, you know, I'd seen Love and Rockets in concert repeatedly, sometimes, you know, in small venues where I'm just right up against the stage, you know, I could reach out and touch them. So, and I'd listen to their music, you know, in every state of mind on acid and every other, you know, psychedelic I could get my hands on for years. So it was quite the experience to like snap out of the overworked haze and be face to face with Daniel Ash. And yeah, I did the fangirl thing too. I mean, I'm usually not intimidated by, you know, celebrity, and Daniel Ash is a very, very minor celebrity in the world of celebrities, but
to them, but not to us.
Right.
You know, to us, it's like, you know, there's different people, you know, Brian Eno, Terrence McKenna, there's people in our world, you know, that to us, and that's great. I mean, Robert Anton Wilson was my most heart beating celebrity. Oh, yeah. It's, you know, I was doing a book talk and I didn't know he was even coming. And and I see him there sitting in the first row. He's sitting next to Ralph Abraham, you know, who's a great a chaos mathematician, psychedelic spiritual author, thinker guy. And I'm like, holy shit, what some, you know, 29-year-old, you know, babe have to say to them, you know, for them. I mean, I figured all I could do at that moment is try to demonstrate to them that I was on the right track, right? And I'm that the kids are all right.
I did a speaking tour, done a few of them, but I did one where I was talking to an assembled group, and I didn't assemble the group, you know, but it was in Portland, Oregon. And there was a guy sitting in the front row who looked just like Bill Murray. And I thought, am I just jabbering in front of Bill Murray? Turns out he wasn't, but I had no way to determine that in the moment, you know? So I just kind of had to set that aside and just keep going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The conversation with Douglas Rushkoff concludes in Sea Realm Vault podcast episode number 471. See KMO's Patreon for details.
All right, that was Douglas Rushkoff. And I mentioned in the conversation that I had spent a lot of time writing a book. The book is called Fear and Loathing in the Kuiper Belt. It is available on Kindle for next to nothing, and it's available in paperback for considerably more than next to nothing. But it will provide you with many hours of entertainment, so I would encourage you to read it in one form or another. Now, I'm going to read for you a reader review left to Amazon.com by Kyle. He gave it 5 stars, and the title of the review is Amazing, with an exclamation point. Kyle writes, "What a fun and fulfilling road. I'm relatively deeply read in science fiction and enjoy classical and contemporary works. Asimov, Clark, Heinlein, Brin, Egan, Vinge, and more. Years ago, this author, KMO, introduced me to my favorite series, Gene Wolfe's Book of the New Sun. Ever since then, I give considerable weight to the science fiction interests KMO shares, and when I learned about his project writing a novel, to say I was excited is an understatement. This book delivers, with rich, layered, quirky characters, the right amount of hardness for my taste in science fiction, ineffable mysteries, absurdity, and hilarious moments, and a lasting sympathy with the characters. I have read and enjoyed Blindsight by Peter Watts, also a swashbuckling adventure in the outer solar system, and recommend both. Fear and Loathing in the Kuiper Belt has more hilarious situations, eclectic cultural references, and sympathetic characters whose paths I want to follow in future installments. I enjoyed the companion/prequel novella, Last Train to Mordor, as well. My complaint about Fear and Loathing is that we don't yet have a next installment." So that's Sea Realm podcast listener and science fiction aficionado Kyle, and his review of my book, Fear and Loathing in the Kuiper Belt, Gen X Science Fiction, to Amazon.com. And let me extend an offer to folks. I know a lot of folks are struggling, and you might have more time, you know, you might have more hours than dollars on your hands. If anybody wants to read the book, but you can't even afford the $4.99 for a Kindle version, you're welcome to send me an email, kmo@c-realm.com. And just ask for a reader copy. I'll send you a PDF with the understanding that it is a review copy. So if you enjoy it, then I would ask that you post a review, either to Amazon or to Goodreads or some other book service that I'm not aware of, or to your blog or social media or wherever. Just share the word. I'd like to get paid. I spent a good many hours, you know, writing, designing, editing, doing all the things that one has to do to create a book and share it with the world. But more than getting paid for my time and effort, I want people to read this story and get to know these characters. So if you'd like to read it, send me an email, kmo@c-realm.com. All right. And as Kyle mentioned, there is a prequel novella that you can read for free on my Substack. My Substack is kmoptimal.substack.com, or just Google Last Train to Mordor. And there I went and used the word Google as a verb. Search. Search for that title and you will find my Substack, where I publish twice a week. On Tuesdays, I write what I consider a sense-making post, just looking at some aspect of the world and trying to make sense of it based on my own viewpoint, knowledge, experience, and way of looking at the world. And on Thursdays, I do some of that as well, but through the lens of examining a particular work of science fiction, or more often, several works of science fiction. The blog is called Gen X, Science Fiction, and Futurism. All right, that is all. Thank you for listening. I'd say I'll talk to you again soon, but I can't promise that. But if you follow my Substack, you'll hear from me soon. So, stay well.